world, and the interview that we're about to hear is with Ed Ellis and his wife Betty at their home at 420 Howard Street, where Betty and Ed still live. Ed, of course, could speak on a number of subjects, having been very involved in the Republican Party in Ottawa County for a number of years, heading up that that committee in this county. But the story that we're going to hear is a very interesting one concerning the leather industry in Grand Haven. And I say the leather industry because it weaves in and out of Eagle, Ottawa. The tales that he has to tell are one of a kind, because I'm not so certain there's anyone left that remembers it quite in the detail that he does. Ed is 91 years old now, but still has a very keen mind, although his eyesight has failed him. But it's a very interesting interview, and one that I have been hopeful that we could make, and very grateful that we did record this. So let's pick up the interview. This right over here. Yeah, or wherever you're comfortable at, really.
Upstairs yet,
because Ed can get up, but he's a little bit worried about coming down these stairs.
But you should hear this. And I'll sit here. How's that? Move this yellow chair around the corner. Yeah, oh, this is good. I don't have to be near the microphone. They don't have to listen to me.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not very good at extemporaneous.
Well, you know, one of the things that has always been fun to talk to you about, of course, is the leather business and how it all... You know that there's some debate as to whether the oldest business in town is Johnson Boiler or whether it is the leather company. Because the leather company, according to records, started out on the corner of First and Fulton. I can't remember the name of the guy that... what leather company was then. Clark Elby, now that name may ring a bell. Of course, Elby Street is named
yeah,
for it.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the one, I think, that moved it out to where it is today, out on Beach Street.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, that leather company was started here in 1836, I think it was.
So, wow.
Of course, that was before your time, Ed.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Not much, yeah.
On the other hand, Dave, that does make sense with the general pattern of the development of different industries in this country. Rough tanning was always one of the earliest that started up in the old days. Because the hides were available, you know, on California. People slaughtering it was a shame to have them go to waste. So somebody said, well, how do the Indians do it? Well, they dig a pit and they cover it with tan bark, and then they put a hide on top of it, and then they put some more tan bark in, and then they soak it with water and let it sit for 6 months. That's about all there was to it in the early days. And so tanning was one of the earliest things. It could be that was the way to that outfit, you know, made harness leather.
Oh, okay.
Or it's on the farm, basically. And it went broke.
Now, you're talking about Eagle, Ottawa. Or it was called what then? Probably just Ottawa leather, wasn't it?
Ottawa Leather Works or something like that. But it went broke, and it is just finishing up production when a big firm of shoe leather tanners in Milwaukee called Fisher & Boulder made a very soul-wrenching decision that the automobile was here to stay, and it wasn't just a fancy.
Okay, then this was about the turn of the century.
Yeah, that's right. And so they, and at that time, all cars were upholstered in leather. town in the Orange, in New Jersey, the center of poultry leather production for the whole country. And they looked around the country and they decided that Detroit was going to win the race between over a half a dozen cities that were making a bid for the home of the automotive industry. But Detroit won out, and the Fisher & Volvo company bet on Detroit, and they bought this bankrupt tannery here in Grand Haven to make the poultry leather. That was the purpose of it, which was bought, because the two are roughly allied to a certain extent in particularly in the earlier stages of making leather. That's the story of the story of the model.
Who were the primary names involved in those early days? Was Hatton involved in it then?
Bill Hatton, I don't think you probably ever knew him.
No, I didn't.
He was the father of Julian Sr. You know him?
No, I didn't. He was killed just before I got here.
Oh, that's so?
Yeah.
Well, he was the father of Julian Sr.
Now, Betty, that would be your what? Of course, Julian Sr. is... You were a Hatton.
Hi?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
No, she's my second wife.
No, that's
my
it.
First,
oh,
my
yeah,
first
it
wife.
First wife.
That was it. Okay.
Kathleen.
All right.
Kathleen was a sister.
About.
She and Olive were sisters.
Okay.
You know Olive?
Yes, yeah.
Well, they were sisters, and their father was a... Oh, he was a... extra plus star salesman for upholstery leather in the East. And so carriage manufacturers galore, and, you know, I'd buy it used in the amount of upholstery leather. And he built up a big name for himself as a star salesman on upholstery leather. And so when the Volvos decided to buy this Grand Haven plant, they also hired Bill Hatton to run it. They felt that all this is an old writing going on. They felt that it would be wise to have a young, aggressive sales type running the business rather than a skilled tanner. Mm-hmm. But as always, you could always hire tanner, but you couldn't hire a good salesman. Some people fail to recognize today. Anyhow, he was hired. He was hired by the Fisher & Volvo company to run this ranch tannery and make a poultry leather and sell it to the rapidly rising automotive industry. And I'll show you what kind of a salesman old Bill was. He was a kind of a personal favorite of mine. I felt differently toward him than you would expect to feel toward your father-in-law. He was a good salesman. In those days, of course, there were no flying anyplace. So you just took trains if you wanted to go from one city to another.
Sure.
And he got on the Wolverine, which is a famous train in the state.
Oh, yes.
In New York City, bound for Detroit, and then transferred it down up to Grand Rapids and then Grand Haven. And when he got on the Wolverine, he, of course, headed for the bug car. He was something of a two-bottle man. And he just was nicely seated in the bug car when he saw a guy that looked familiar to him from the paper, picture in the paper. It was W.C. Durant. He went over and introduced himself to Durant. And they decided it was about time to have a mutual drink, so they did. And they got telling stories to each other, you know. Both were en route to start a new plant that they'd never even seen before, in a factory that they'd never even seen before. Bill and Grand Haven, when the Eagle Leather worked, and W.C. Durant was the original General Motors, and which he'd never seen before.
Sure.
Headquarters in Flint, okay. And they got so buddy-buddy on the train that when Durant got off the train in Lansing, the train from Grand Rapids to from Detroit to Grand Rapids, Bill hadn't had in his pocket a signed order from W.C. Durant that said, to all concerned in the employment of the General Motors Corporation, delivered to the bearer on demand orders for 10,000 hides of Toshiba, 5,000 hides of Peacock, and 25,000 hides of Hambuck Leather. To be delivered to him and schedule and arrange the time of delivery. That there was a year's business.
I was going to say, that's a pretty good day's work.
Well, that's what it amounted to. They,
yeah.
He got the plant started. He, somehow or other, in his travels, he'd been born in Ireland. You
know. Ireland?
Yeah, he was born in this country. Uh-huh. And he came over here, and somehow or other, after he got here, he got to be friendly with the English and impressed him as being a very quiet sort of a guy, but very capable. And that was Stanley Sutherland, our first superman.
Of course.
First and only superman.
Huh.
The general superintendent of Eagle Auto from the day was old Bill Hatton hired him until old Bill died and Stanley finally retired. But that's the story of the early birds.
Yeah. Huh. Now, after the Milwaukee firm came over here, when did it change to Eagle Auto? Was it at that time?
No.
Or did it Eagle?
There was a concern up at Whitehall.
Oh, okay.
There was a tannery up there. At one time, it appeared advantageous to buy them up. And Bill Hatton, as head of the Grand Haven Company, had enough working capital that he generated in the business, and also enough more that he could get from the original Christian Volvo company, so that he was able to purchase the Whitehall. And one of them was Eagle, and the other was one of the Eagle Tanning Company, and the other was the Ottawa Leather Works. And the two, they combined the two names in the beginning, the Eagle Auto of the Bay, of course, got its name.
So the principal owners at that time were still Milwaukee people.
Oh, yes, yes. The Hatton family never got control of the business. They tried hard enough to. But the Fisher and Roland people were. Got to where their income was greater from Eagle Auto than it was from their original interest in Milwaukee. So they would never release except small amounts of the stock. Bill Hatton was smart enough businessman to know that his cue, if he could do it, was to get actual control of the business. 51% of them.
Sure.
Voting stock, but he was never able to do it.
And they probably made sure of that.
Yeah.
Now, your role in it and the plant that went over, was over on Park Street. How did that all evolve?
Well, that was the later story of the Eagle Ottawa leather company after it was in full production here, all those stone buildings built to make up the present tannery out of Beach Street and Fulton Street. The Great Depression came along, and Eagle Ottawa, unlike most companies, never lost hardly any business, any money in business. We were able to hold on to our share of the automobile trade, and that was enough that by economies and one thing another, we could barely show a little profit actually every year of the Big Depression. Enough to, you know, to keep the wolf from the door.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, previous to the Great Depression, Eagle Ottawa had built up a big cash reserve. A heck of a lot of money for a business that size to have in their reserve, but nevertheless they had it. And the Western Global people had been constantly urging old Bill to declare more and more of it out of dividends, which he by one means or another kind of stalled from doing, you know, the old game of the double talk and triple talk and not actually violating direct orders from your superior, but at least the appearance of it, one thing or another. So he held these reserves together pretty well. And then the Depression hit rock bottom. The Moles didn't have enough money to eat in Milwaukee. So they ordered Bill to start declaring out all their surplus as a dividend. Then they get their hooks on it and get money for it. He refused to do it. And at the same time, he had a terrible operation for cancer of the throat that left him so he could hardly talk. So that all combined, he retired then. And Julian, the one that died before
yes.
he came here, and he became president of the business. And he didn't... see to their wishes about bearing out the surplus and didn't do it. And I was a number two man in the organization.
Mm-hmm.
I ran the sales end and sales and style and I was positive that Julian was going to get fired, and I kept telling him so. I said, you're not going to last a year more. I said, they're going to give you the sack, no question about it. I said, you either got to give in to them and get rid of all that surplus and maybe go broke in the bargain because they don't have enough reserves left, or else you're going to get fired. No, I'm going to pull this thing through. I know how to handle those damn locals. He said, I'm not going to let them tell me what to do. I went ahead and made plans of starting up a finishing shop. Where I would buy the leather all tan, ready to put the coats of finish on it. Not as much money as tanning yourself, but still, it didn't require the working capital that the whole operation was. And I certainly didn't have the working capital, so I couldn't think of anything else. I had a place made out, picked out, where I was going to operate from the town of Powell. You know how on
sure.
60 miles from Detroit.
Sure.
And I think that as being a model town to operate from, because it's so easy to get to Detroit from the area,
uh-huh.
and yet remote from Detroit labor wise.
Yes.
How people weren't UAW people.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they had a different name than UAW. I was far enough along that I settled on the design. See, I took mechanical engineering at Ann Arbor. So I had never practiced engineering because I found it more interesting and more to my liking and more profitable to sell engineered products to engineers and to be an engineer myself.
Uh-huh.
So I never practiced engineering at all. But still, I had that training, so I made a layout of the proposed finishing shop I was going to do. And I even had blueprints made of the layout. And I was getting ready to start a campaign to raise money. What are you going to do with this? You're not going to put it in print, are you?
No, but it'll be on record.
Be where?
Well, yeah. This is, for example, I have Ollie Harbeck. I've got Ollie Teisman. You know who Ollie Teisman is?
No.
92 years old, World War One. Of course, I have Chuck Pagelski, and a lot of the things Chuck Pagelski told me, I don't know if you would want to have those repeated, but I don't know how you erase them. So don't tell me anything you don't want to.
Go on, go in print.
I got Claude Verdine before he died, too.
Oh, that's
very right. Happy with that.
Yeah,
Glenn Eaton. And
well,
so anyway, was it going to be a stock company, or?
It was going to be a partnership. And the partners were going to be limited to four at the most.
Uh-huh.
One each from the Fisher Division of General Motors.
Oh.
One from Chrysler and one from Ford. And one from me.
And that would have your sale, the sale of your product was guaranteed.
Yeah, well, that was there was nothing illegal about it.
Sure.
But it wasn't exactly the best possible business ethics.
Uh-huh.
But it was very commonly done in the old days, organizing businesses to sell to yourself.
Uh-huh. Right.
It was one of the standard ways of making more than your salary. And I there was no other way I could have financed the business. And I had the backing of one of those four people. And I had a statement made in the presence of half a dozen important people under it by W.A. Fisher, who was vice president of General Motors and president of the Fisher Division of General Motors.
Which is Fisher Body.
Which is Fisher Body, yeah. And he would back us with a letter, the orders. And of course, in those days, getting an order for something was, it was just a miracle. You know, we reached almost a high of almost 50% unemployed in this country.
Yeah, right.
And which meant that at no time were we producing more than half the goods that we were capable of producing. Mm. So you can imagine the competition for each order was unbelievable. But I was promised that they would back us with plenty of orders. That was all that was necessary. And simultaneously, with the getting that all done in Detroit, kind of sub rosa, you know.
Yeah.
And asking people to keep it a secret until I announce it myself, and you know, playing on friendship, steadily. It didn't leak out in Grand Haven at all. It was fairly well known in the leather and the upholstery end of the automotive trade, but it never reached here. When the axe fell and Julian got fired.
And he really did.
Yeah, he really did get fired. Uh-huh. He came to work and a Jewish guy by the name of Sam Slicker was sitting at his desk.
Oh. Now, what year was this? 40s or 30s?
This was about 33, 34.
Oh, boy.
Right at the bottom of the Depression.
Oh, that was the worst time.
Yeah. And it was kind of a traumatic experience for Julian. You know, he'd been sort of raised on the fact that the Hatton family was a dynasty. It wasn't
right.
Just a family, you know. It was something you read about in books and all like that.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't turn out that way. And so he got the sack, and it took him about 3 days to recover mentally from it. When he got recovered, he came around here to the house, and we were living here, right where we are now.
Uh-huh.
And he said that I suppose you're wondering what I'm going to do. And I said, yeah, naturally I am. I said, you got any plans? And he said, yes. He said, they may include you too. He said, I'm going to start a business of my own, making a upholstery leather, finishing. And he said, how would you like to come in with me as a partner in the deal? And I said, offhand, I'd say without any question, yes. But I said, where are you going to sell it? And he said, what do you... He was never a profane person, you know. And he was kind of stuffy that way.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. But he broke down and he said, well, that's what the hell I'm going to get you the partner for.
He did.
And I said, well, as long as that's understood, I said, I'd be glad to go on the deal with it. And we arrived at a gentleman's agreement that we would own percentages of the business based on what money, and I was able to scare up $40,000 in various sources, and Julian got $60,000 together. And so we started out on a 60-40 basis. And we continued that right up to the time that the little business that we started was ended. And the reason it was ended was that I'd been a an officer in the regular army. As a result, I got called up just as early as it was legal to call anybody. So I was down in Texas wearing a uniform almost a year before Pearl Harbor.
Oh, well, I'm darn.
During that time, everything sort of stabilized. They hadn't started to make automobiles, but there were other outlets for leather. Julian then had it all by himself and became modestly profitable. It looked as if it wouldn't be long before the war would be over, one thing or another, we'd start making a quality of leather again, and we'd be off for my old time.
Now, this is the plant over on Park Street.
Yeah, that was the first plant we had. We bought one of the Quonset Hut up there.
Okay.
And put in a lot of new innovations that we thought of. Some of them were our ideas, some of them were ideas that we got from smart friends, and some were ideas we swiped from competitors. We didn't care where a good idea came.
It worked, it worked. Okay.
Just so
is that right? Isn't that great? Yeah. Now, where were you getting your hides from?
From a variety of sources. Tanners who tanned leather but did not finish it, of which there were three or four in the country. And they were very helpful in our getting started. And gave us, in most cases, Julian handled that end of the business exclusively. He had the name and, the past history with his father and all. So he handled that end, and he was able to get where we did most of our buying on a 90-day term. Then along came the end of the war, I came home, we started making a poultry leather, we couldn't turn that out fast enough. As soon as we were able to go up to two ships, we went to two ships. We tried three ships, but we found that we lost money on the third ship, so heavily we couldn't afford to have it. And we couldn't get the supervision in anything. The Vogels by that time, before I came home, while I was still in Europe, they got just thoroughly discouraged at the situation of being lava. And they called up the head of the business, who was then the son of the man that who fired you. So the two were, at least had a pretense of being good personal friends. And he said, in effect, he said, "Julian, we're ready to dump you on, and we don't know where to dump it except back on your shoulder. What do you take for it?" And he said, he could say, "Well, I'd better get some people, good accounting people, to give you an answer to that. If you're really serious." And he said, "We're deadly serious." He said, "You make us any reasonable offer." And he said, "I'll guarantee acceptance of it." This was about the tail end of World War II. I was still in the United States.
Mr. Jurosik wanted to know what he could tell the Rotarians. I didn't tell him to say you were very obstreperous.
John.
Wearing Mama to a frazzle.
Yeah. What did John want?
He just wanted to know what he could tell the Rotarians about your,
how
you were.
Oh, yeah.
He reports every Monday.
And I said, Pete Tellis was here yesterday, and he could check with him, too.
Yeah. Well, anyhow.
Excuse me for interrupting.
They arrived at a price. And
now, you were still in the service.
Yeah, I was still in the service, still in New York.
But nevertheless, you were still a 60-40 partner in the business.
Oh, yeah.
So.
But they finally came up with a sum of $1.25 million that what the Vogels wanted in cash to make the trade or to make the sale.
Mm-hmm.
Some friend of Julian's up in Grand Rapids, he was having lunch up there, said, you know, there's a guy here in town that's around peddling money. He said, that's what it amounts to. He said, it sounds crazy, but he said, he's got scads of money at his beck and call, and he's putting it out where he can make a little money on the money.
Mm-hmm.
He said, why don't you get in touch with him? Well, he did. And he was a man who, taking advantage of the times, had gotten control over large sums of money from a big credit company in the East. Their business primarily was financing heavy equipment, heavy household equipment. Washing machines, all the paraphernalia of heavy domestic business.
Automobiles included, or that?
No, not automobiles. Everything but cars.
Okay.
I guess they purposely stayed out of the automobiles. Yeah.
Now, was he a local person?
No, he was from the East. He negotiated a very healthy finder's fee for having access to the name of this company in the East, which we paid up in full to him very, very gladly, as a matter of fact, because the deal went through along with the end of the war coming. All of a sudden, this company that was in the finance business was going broke because nobody wanted to borrow any money from them.
Mm.
You know, when you stop to think of it, a banker can't stay a banker unless he's loaning money.
Yeah.
Because he makes his livelihood off his loans. And it was the same way with this finance company. They had no market for their money. Now the war is stopping all production of heavy household machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And he got Union got the money and signed their names to the necessary papers and became the owner of the old Eagle Auto and Leather Company.
Mm-hmm.
And Julian telling me after about the thing, and said that they had a big hullabaloo about what the name of the new about. And somebody said, well, the old Eagle Auto and Leather Company didn't have a hyphen between the Eagle and the Auto. Why don't we stick a hyphen between the two names now? And that'll be the name of the new firm, which was a merger of the Eagle Tanning Works and the Ottawa Leather Works.
Okay.
And the Happy Mother Company, which is the name that Julian wanted for the business that we owned together. And what happened, in about 3 years' time, Julian and I had put in a total of $100,000 into this business. 60 he put in, 40 I put in. And in less than 3 years, we became the owner of the entire Eagle Auto Leather Company, doing around $10 million worth of sales a year.
Gee, isn't that great?
Yeah.
Tell me this, the business that you started, or were going to start it, with the Fisher person being affiliated.
Yeah.
Now, is that what the business that you and Julian finally did put together?
No.
Oh, no. Yours is going to be a little different than that.
Ours was definitely on a higher ethical plane. We raised our own money.
Yes, I realize that.
Put our own money in.
But the business was about the way you had designed
just,
it.
Just exactly.
Okay.
I went down to Detroit and I had sample hides that we'd made up. He never was any good with his hands. You know. Mm-hmm. The guy we hired to be our superintendent and I had personally made the first 2-3 hides. And boy, we slaved over them. Made sure they were absolutely perfect in every respect.
Yeah.
And I took those in a big bundle down to Detroit with me a sample. And I walked into the office of a man that was he was group purchasing agent for the Fisher Division of General Motors. And I said, "Fred, I'm here with samples, and a very humble but sincere request for some business." Well, it's always a little nicer to at least pretend he's a pro. He said, "Well, that's great." And he said, "I'll send the samples over to engineering right away to get them tested." And he said, "Do you think they'll pass every test?" And I said, "Well, they've already passed every test that we know of, so we ought to." And they did. And in a couple of days, we reached the stage where he said, "Now look," he said, "how much you want me to make this order out for?" He said, "Now don't get hungry." He said, "Don't bite off more than you can chew." He said, "I don't want you stubbing your toe on your very first order with General Motors on this." And I said, "No." I said, "I'll take so much business. And then when we satisfied you on that, I'll come back and ask for another order." He said, "You do that." He said, "If you don't stub your toe," and he said, "I'll guarantee there'll be another order waiting for you."
Huh.
So that's the way it went.
Yeah.
So we were all just like old Bill was when he landed with that order.
Yeah, sure.
W.C. Durant in his pocket. We started out with all the things we could make right from the very start. As soon as the War Production Board in Washington released hides so that we could buy raw material, we released them from being under
war duty, war restrictions.
We could start making stuff for automobiles, and most important of all, that Detroit could start making automobiles.
Happened
on the same day, as a matter of fact. The government released a whole section of American industry. Everything connected with automobile production was all released of all government control all on the same day.
46, was it?
Yeah, 46.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And from then on, it was just a madhouse turn the stuff out.
Oh, yeah. Right. And the, as I remember, the quality of the cars coming out at that time was not, they were, you bought them regardless, but it was not what you would describe as top quality.
No, no.
You kind of, every time you bought a new car, it was on a shakedown cruise.
Yeah, that's well put.
Yeah.
They, one thing that we were able to do was that the interest on that $1.25 million loan that we had to have in this finance company,
yes,
to swing the deal was very oppressive. It wasn't ruinous, but it held us back.
Well, 3 or 4% was a hefty interest in those days.
Yeah, and I was able to do something at the very last before I got called into service. So while they were still making cars in Detroit, the government had rescinded the right to make automobiles. I went to the Fisher Division and said, "Now look, we've had about a year. You've been using our stuff for a year. We haven't." Whoever I was talking to said, "Well, what do you want?" And I said, "Well, I said, you know, we put on our letterhead terms 210 net 30 days. The 2% discount is paid within 10 days, net due if you take 30 days. Mm-hmm. And I said, nobody pays any attention to it. You people take an average of just about 45 days. And I said, you know, salesmen for different companies talk. I said, they're talkers to begin with. And so that I said, they always talk. And I said, I know that 45 days is just about your average that takes you to pay a bill. And this guy said, well, that's right. He said, I said, well, there's this old term in the leather business that will give you a half or 1% a month off the invoice if you'll pay us within the shortest possible time. And I said, in the case that I've got in mind, it would mean getting paid by you within about 7 or 8 or 9 days from the time you ship the letter. And the guy threw up his hand and he said, oh my God, nobody's ever heard of anything like that. He said, not since the earliest days. He said that Durant would turn over in his grave if he heard it. And I said, well, I said, Fred, it's this way. I said, we're plumb out of money. I said, we borrowed money. We borrowed locally at the local bank until they couldn't supply us in the amounts that we needed. And then they set us up with a guaranteed trust in Chicago. And we've had an excellent relationship with them ever since. And we're up to our credit limit with them. And they can't loan us anymore without changing their own rules. And you can't blame them for not wanting to do that. But I said, we just need more money than we can get it and lay our hands on to enlarge our business. I said, and incidentally, serve you better. And he said, well, he said, how would that do you any good? And I said, now this is just between you and me. So I said, we're buying most of our raw materials on a 90-day basis. if we can get to selling you on 10 days or 9 days in basis, I said, just imagine what that'll do to our turnover on our working capital. In those days, nobody thought of the term cash flow.
Yeah, true. You're right. You never.
It was an undiscovered term. I figured that in our little way, we probably got on to the fact that cash flow is more important than actual net on the bottom of the order.
Sure.
You'd rather have 2% net profit multiplied 50 times than you would 10% only multiplied once. He said, well, he said, come on, we'll go down the hall and talk with you people. So we did, and I finally got up and I saw W.A. Fisher again.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and he said, well, he said, sounds to me just like a slick scheme to get money out of General Motors. And I said, well, sir, I said, it's a slick scheme to get money out of General Motors, I'll admit. But I said, there's nothing the least bit underhand or anything else about it. He said, well, what's in it for us? And I said, there's just one thing, Mr. Bishop. I said, Fred here can tell you that from the very start of our business, and even before that, when we were just paid businessmen running the Eagle out of another company, I really have completely run the sales end and controlled it, and thereby controlling the production of the plant. And during that entire time, you've never needed anything you didn't get from us. I said, sometimes the other customers went hungry for another, sometimes they lost their customers because they were not filling orders as promised. But I said, regardless of what it took, broken promises or anything else, you always got what you asked for from Eagle Auto Leather Company. And that is our basic policy. We are a General Motors supplier from start to finish. And I said, we owe you a personal loyalty because of past personal favors. And also, we owe you a business loyalty because you're the basis of all the money we've ever made. It's been based on doing business with General Motors. And I said, that's the answer. What is there for us in this sort of a deal? I said, give us 1 year on these terms and we'll make enough money so that we can fill your purchasing department here. Not quite as I said, we can keep them well supplied with all they can digest inside of a year if we can have a year on the basis of those terms. And I figured out after. No, I didn't figure it out, but Milt Bird did. Milt was our first male employee. And he became sort of general factotum. He was a good man, pride, you know.
Yeah.
He figured out that in our last full year, that the automotive industry had before the government started to cut down on them, that we turned our working capital 22 times in one 12-month period. You know, a grocery store, which is supposed to be the greatest turnover industry in the world, is selling large quantities of groceries. If a grocery store can turn their working capital 10 or 12 or 15 times, they think they're doing an unbelievable job. Well, we got 22 turnovers a year and making a nice net on each turnover. And that, my friend, is the way to make money.
Yeah.
lot of money in a short length of time.
And it was a good deal for them, though.
Yes, yeah. Okay. They got just exactly what I said they were going to get. They got first call on all of our production whenever they wanted. And that's the way it lasted as long as I was on the job.
But Ed, back in those days, there weren't that many cars that had leather.
No,
we had
there
a lot
weren't.
Of cloth seats and, but ours, there was and plastic.
There was a good market for them because in the real early days, when Eagle Auto was just getting started, all the cars were leather.
Sure.
And gradually the percentage of leather dropped off as the closed car came in. It dropped off and dropped off and dropped off. But it always remained up around 7 or 8% of their total production because of export. A lot of countries wouldn't buy a car unless it was leather upholstery.
Mm-hmm.
And convertibles.
Yes.
You sell a lot of convertibles. So that the aggregate market was still a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And plenty of elbow room in the market to make good money on it. To show you how things have changed today, somebody somebody at Rotary, I guess, who works for the present Eagle Auto, told me that something like 60 to 70% of all Cadillacs made today are leather upholstered.
Right. It has changed that much, sure. Yeah. It's just that it upgrades the quality of the car.
Yeah.
And it's not just Chrysler, Cadillac. Chrysler has gone to it, too.
Yeah, and Ford.
Yeah.
Ford has the distinction today of actually selling leather by the hide to Japanese manufacturers of cars in Japan.
Well, are they, they're buying it from, say, Eagle Auto and then selling it to Japan?
Eagle Auto is selling it directly to the Mitsubishi Motor Company.
Oh, I see.
Of Japan.
Okay.
Who are then cutting it out to pattern and putting it on the car.
Well, that's quite a history.
I guess that's a basic story of it. The present management at Eagle Auto have been doing they either don't want publicity or they don't know how to handle it. Because the people around town, I don't feel, realize what a damn good job they're doing.
I think you're right.
They've completely revolutionized the production. It's being made by all new methods, new machinery. There's nothing of the old Eagle Auto left at all. It took a new bunch of people, a new spirit, and a new outlook on things, newly trained background. To do what they've done, but they fooled around after they bought out their tannery.
That's right. And another Milwaukee group came over and bought out.
Yeah.
You, I guess it would be, wasn't it?
Well, no. I wanted out before that deal.
I see.
It came to pass. I was just tired of the business. I'd reached a stage where I couldn't go to any of the annual shows without kicking myself in the fanny. and I didn't, I had lost all interest in the work or anything.
Sure.
And so I knew it was time for me to get out. So I dickered with young Judy.
Okay.
Young president, you know.
Yeah.
When her father was killed.
That would have been about 52 or 3 or 4, yeah. Somewhere in there.
Yeah. And we finally arrived at a term. And so I sold out. So I sold my stock back to the original Iguala Leather Company.
Okay.
Where it became company stock. And incidentally, I did a nice favor to the people who later sold out to the Fisker and Volvo, not Fisker and Volvo, but the
Trasco.
The Trasco Leather Company. But so much of the stock had been retired that what the individual held was worth that much more. But,
oh, sure.
And so it worked out. Good deal. I got a fair amount of money out of the deal, and it wasn't what I would like to have had, or talk about it, missed opportunity. Julian Senior, the one that you knew.
Yes.
He was kind of a real set in his ways, certain ideas, and one of his ideas was that he would never part with any of his stock. Nothing would ever induce him. So $1 million a share would have been interesting. But along comes some slick guys, good talkers, and they sure didn't take any great effort on their part to convince me that they could have my stock in it. And what they were going to do, they were going to get maybe half of the outstanding stock, half of the half of my stock, and put it on the market. You know how skilled
a broker
will feed out stuff. You know, he watches the ticker. If the ticker goes down, he stops selling. If it goes up, he sells some more.
Uh-huh.
And he keeps feeding it out that way, as fast as the market will absorb it. Sometimes it takes him a couple of years to unload the stock. But that was the plan. He was going to do that. And he said that the price at which he was going to offer it was more than satisfactory. He said that, first he said, I'll shade that as time goes on. He said, like anything else, he said, you have to sweeten it up, sweeten the deal from time to time. But you can bank on a really good return. Well, it would have put Julian and myself in the We'd have been on a real easy street.
Yeah, yeah.
That clock is fast, but you aren't going to make longer, are you?
Oh, well, that's... We still have 15 minutes. Well, it's 10 to.
Well, that's...
Yeah.
That's all.
So you...
We missed that up.
Yeah. It wasn't a local.
I have no complaint. I got enough money out of it. We live comfortably.
Sure. That was. I don't think people realize. Of course they don't realize the history of that business and how tumultuous it really was. It wasn't always a happy deal. All the way.
Yeah.
It was in and out. And
yeah.
JSJ, of course, started in the lifetime of a good many people around here, so they've seen it go and they know the history of that.
Yeah.
But Eagle Ottawa goes back far enough that it was lost in history.
Yeah, that's right.
Very interesting. Now tell me, why aren't there any Democrats in Ottawa County? You were the chairman of the...
He swept them all out.
We ought to touch on that before Betty tells us about her career.
She's got a...
Get that way for a while.
Very interesting.
I don't want you missing Rotary and having to pay a quarter.
Oh, what, we don't pay fines. No, how did you become an artist? You were... Did you draw as a youngster, or...
Yes, I drew as a youngster, but I drew Buster Brown and the Katzenjammer from the Funny Paper. Now, you wouldn't remember.
Oh, yes, I did. And
oh,
I used,
you do?
I used to copy... it wasn't Mickey Mouse at that time. Who was the mouse? Crazy Cat. Remember Crazy Cat?
Yes, there was a mouse, too, but he was later.
I used to copy Crazy Cat.
The Buster Brown was one of the earliest.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just thinking, my family came to Grand Haven. My grandmother and grandfather lived here on Lake Avenue.
All right, now their names would have been what?
Terry.
Oh, Terry. Oh.
Senator Terry.
Oh, of course.
My cousin.
I really? Well, of course. And there were Terrys in Jackson, Michigan, too.
I don't think they were the same family.
Yeah, and I'll tell you who they... Sumner.
Yeah. One of his children?
Yeah, exactly.
I was wondering what became of those four.
Yeah. Well, now Mike.
Yeah.
Let's see, Mike is still around. That would have been Sumner's son.
Yeah, they both of them married Sumner.
Okay.
Married.
Okay.
But she died.
Yes.
And she had Pat.
Pat.
The bishop.
That's the one that lived
and
in Jackson.
Mike.
Okay.
Now, does Pat come back to that house that summer?
Of course, he sold Mike.
Well, Mike had it built out there.
Yeah, right.
But the estate lived down the lake.
Okay, now, I don't know. I'm not totally familiar with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know we were associated with the Terrys before we came to Grand Haven.
Oh.
I didn't realize that you were related to them.
Oh, that's so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were first cousins.
Well, now about the painting. Were these prize winners that you were doing when you were 8, 9 years old?
These were childish squalls. And I don't think I became serious about painting until I married Ed and we started having trips to interesting places. And I knew that oils wouldn't dry. I couldn't rag those around. And I wanted some record of the places we went to. So I chose watercolor because it was easier to
sure.
handle. And all that.
And I
got stuck with it.
You did the Caribbean. You were down the Caribbean for a while, weren't you?
Yeah. And I painted all the time when we started traveling that way. I didn't try it going around the world. I couldn't handle things on the boat very well. But then when we came back and settled down, I met the beginnings of the Lake Containers crew. There were about six of us. Shirley Schroeder, Norma Sweeney, Marie Jordan, I think Connie also, and myself. I wasn't even the first. There were about three at first. I think Shirley and a couple. And we had various studios around town. I don't know whether you were aware of any of them.
I knew that you didn't have a central headquarters.
No.
Yeah. That was more of a come to my basement this week.
Attic,
okay.
But it was lots of fun.
Yeah.
Painted everything in sight. And it was just, as Ed reminds me, you have to turn out miles and miles of work to get anything worthwhile.
Yeah.
So the attic's full, the basement's full, under my bed is full. unsuccessful things.
But I'll tell you, of that group that you're talking about, they were either, they developed as they grew together, or else they were very accomplished when they began, because their works have become...
Noreen's come a long way.
Oh, yeah.
About Josh here now. And Shirley was stopped when she was painting. I hope she gets back to it.
And you're still painting? Mm-hmm. No, you can't see well enough.
That's 5 years, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm just resting on my laurels now. Yeah. I have a granddaughter that's coming along nicely, and I'm hoping that I can have the community center give her a show.
Yeah.
I think it'd be kind of fun for grandmother presenter.
Oh, that'd be great.
Granddaughter, don't you?
Where does she live?
In Chicago.
With your reputation, I don't think you'd have any trouble.
Well, I thought I would go down and check. Yeah, I think it'd be kind of fun.
Oh, absolutely.
If she can produce enough. She's working now in, she's studying. One of the best. I don't know what it is. In Chicago.
Well, not the Art Institute, wouldn't be.
I think so.
That's where quite a few of them go, right there, you know, on Michigan Ave, isn't it, Ed? Yeah, or you know where it is, Betty. Yeah. With the lions out in front. I think they have quite a school there.
She's in the graphic art now. I don't think I like that. Cutting out stuff.
Yes.
Pasting it.
No, I don't know that.
Anyway, I don't see that.
Well, you know, now that you've stopped, probably the value of your work is just increasing daily. There is no more. That happens with the people.
Ed would never let me sell, so I just gave away a lot. Now I wish I hadn't, because my children and my grandchildren are eager to get them, and that is reward enough.
Sure. Well, you know, some of the Picasso original sketches that were worthless when he was doing them now are very valuable. So all of that stuff under your bed and down in the basement and up in the attic, that'll become...
Who knows? Maybe there's a treasure in there somewhere.
Absolutely.
I couldn't see it if it were. I'll have to send Judy Hatch up there to call him out.
Now, who is Judy Hatch? Is that...
She's my first son's wife.
Oh, I see.
And she's an avid collector.
Yeah.
A few things out of the cottage. Things are very precious.
Now, you still have your cottage?
Oh, my, yes.
Now, do you go out there at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I escaped the cottage when things get a little thick around town.
Yeah.
Yes, it's on Lover's Lane.
Sure.
It's been winterized.
I see.
Winterized and brought up to date, the new wiring, you know.
Sure.
New heating.
Well, my brother lived there. He was in a wheelchair for 30 years, this guy. When his wife died, he told me he had this dream of coming out to live at the cottage. So I got Jim Jordan on the job. And he was alive.
Oh, before Jim died.
And he did it.
Huh.
He had 2 years there.
He had two of the happiest years of his life.
Yeah, he said they were. Remember,
an experiment went in. And he could drive manually.
Yes. I know where the Hatton place was out there. Now, it's along the boardwalk. Is that how you get to it?
No, it's Lover's Lane. It's behind the Fredell Hotel.
Right smack behind.
Oh, horseshoe curve there.
Yes, I know where it is.
Right in the middle.
Yeah, I know.
Over there.
And you have a good view of the lake?
No, we don't see the lake.
Okay.
I used to regret that, but now that all of Western Michigan convenes us.
Well, that's right. It'll be right in front of you there.
On the beach. And we're just as well pleased we're taking that.
Well, this has been a lot of fun.
Well, I feel a strong sense of embarrassment I've had.
Oh, listen, this is great history, though, Ed. And you know,
out of turn.
You can't write anymore. The only way you're going to get this history down is to have someone dictate it.
Yeah.
Or take dictation, I should say. And this, in a sense, is what that is. Yeah. You know,
so it is history.
You're darn right it is.
Evolved.
Oh, I tell you. And if, you know, if it is right that it is the oldest business in town, if it started in 1836 or 7, somewhere in there, I don't remember the exact date, you're the only continuity that's left.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And so you have to be able to, to get this down somehow. So if there's anything else you can remember, call me back.
Yes, well, that is it. That's certainly part of Grandy's history.
Well, it is, right. You see, if you date it back to 1836, say, and we were organized in 34, and so 2 years after, it wouldn't have been out of the question to have it in 36. Mm-hmm. That makes it, what's 36 from 91? That in itself is 51 years, isn't it?
I can't add that fast. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's 100 and... It's over 150 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I'm trying to get the county enthused about is saving the home. You know where the Royal Dry Cleaners is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. The house going toward the river from there. Mm-hmm. From there. That house was the Nathan Throop house. Mm-hmm. And he built that in about 1836. When the county became a county in 37, the very first county meeting was held in that home.
That's
right. Isn't that a bed and breakfast now?
No, it's kind of a nothing right now.
Oh, it should be.
Yeah, it should at least be preserved to the point that when the person who is living in it dies, it won't be torn down.
Yeah.
At least the county will recognize that it has some work.
Oh, it should be restored just as is.
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. Don't know.
Yeah.
Of course, that's the problem with being a historian. You want to restore everything, and it can't be done. It's not practical to do it in everything, but I don't want to see anything torn down.
Well, this house here, you know, is about, we figure, 125 years old.
Gee.
This was built by one of the four men that were the original lumber barons, Van Haven.
Oh, yes.
He owned the mill.
Now, Cutler Savage.
I'll get the picture.
And I've forgotten what the guy's name was that owned this place. I looked it up once on the flat book, you know.
Yeah, sure.
The city hall, the county building.
Yeah, right.
Well,
let's see what Betty's getting.
You follow her up. I don't know where she went.
All right. Well.